This podcast is recorded on stolen and unceded Aboriginal land.
We acknowledge the First Nations and elders of this country, and we join their calls for justice. Well, I was just reading this piece called Fighting Fit, Image Consultant Reveals How Leaders Prepare for the Poll, by private Sydney columnist Andrew Hornery. Now, I know you shouldn't make fun of people's names, Emerald Moon, but I think if a guy's name is Andrew Hornery, then you're allowed to laugh at that. That's okay.
Yeah, Emerald Moon is better than that.
I think so. Between Labor leader Anthony Albanese's hip new spectacles, sharper suits, oversized Akubra and 15-kilogram weight loss, and Prime Minister Scott Morrison's white thongs, fish curries, curiously thicker hairline, it would appear the image makers are well into campaign mode ahead of the next federal election.
Yeah. I ask the weight and measurements of all of my political candidates at the voting booth. And I will not vote until they tell me.
Now check this out. I signed a 30-page non-disclosure contract that still binds me today. One stylist who has worked on successful election campaigns informed me last week.
No way.
Still too nervous to be named. Holy shit.
Okay, that's wild. That's amazing.
30-page non-disclosure contract if you told Tony Abbott to look less like a lizard.
Okay.
Or told Bill Shorten to lose some weight or to go running.
Unnamed source. Our DMs are open. Like, just make a burner account.
Yes.
Send us through this contract because it would just be such golden content.
Emerald has committed to covering all your legal fees if you do reach out. We discuss this further.
Yeah.
Our current Prime Minister is often posing in the Kirribilli kitchen, as he did most recently, making a New Year fish curry. Back in 2005, I inadvertently ignited a storm of controversy after writing about Julia Gillard's bare fruit bowl sitting in her eerily lifeless kitchen when she posed for photographers at home ahead of becoming Labor leader and ultimately PM. I was also echoing what many readers were saying about that image, a rare glimpse into the private domain of a political leader. At the time, as I pondered why Australia's first potential female prime minister would be located in her kitchen for the photo shoot at all. Okay.
Yeah.
So he was doing feminism by saying, well, we shouldn't be seeing this woman in the kitchen.
Yeah.
But also, why is this woman's fruit bowl so empty?
I've never been in a kitchen because I'm a real feminist.
Did you get any styling advice when you were a Greens candidate?
Maybe I should have. Maybe I would have beat Andrew Lambing if I had this guy.
Well, if you look too good, I think Andrew Lambing might have paid you more attention, you know?
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Can I just say, on the measure of extremities, the most extreme political movement on offer in this election is the Greens. The Greens are far more extreme than Clive Palmer or One Nation.
Frankly, I've always found the Greens to be a real serious danger to Australia.
Serious danger to Australia.
Hello and welcome, Akubra wearers, horn rimmed glasses wearers, and everyone in between. This is Serious Danger, a podcast about green politics in Australia. My name's Emerald Moon. Hi, Tom. This is Tom Ballard.
Hello, Emerald. It's me, Tom Ballard. Hi, everyone.
Hi. This is not, before we get into it, this is not an official Greens Party podcast. Mm-mm. We talk about things, but we are not the Greens. We're Greens members. Please send all your complaints to us and not to them. This week, we are talking a little bit, mostly, you know, a couple of COVID things. We're talking about Novak Djokovic. We're discussing Hillsong parties and double standards when it comes to COVID regulations. And we'll be chatting to a Rente woman, trade unionist, writer, activist, and Greens candidate for Cooper, Celeste Little.
Yay.
About a bunch of cool things. She's fantastic. So that's very exciting.
Well, we're going to be telling her off for running in a Labor-held seat against a progressive Labor woman, which is bad.
She was good until she announced her candidacy. Before we get into it, we wanted to ask friends. We're thinking next episode of doing an Ask Me Anything.
AMA. We've hit the bottom of the barrel. We've got nothing else to say. This is when podcasts get desperate.
Yeah. But if there is something that you want to know, please DM us or email us. You can email us, what is it, hello@seriousdangerpod.com.
That's right.
Or just send us a message on Instagram or Twitter. We're at SeriousDangerAU. But, yeah, anything that, you know, you want us to kind of address on the show, whether it's about us or the show or kind of the Greens movement and the election, what other things can people ask about, Tom?
Styling tips, obviously.
Styling tips.
That's big. How do we do it? How do we manage to keep so hot and so left-wing at all times?
Is Emerald free on Friday night for dinner and a movie? Things like that, maybe.
Do you know Andrew Hornery? These are questions that we could answer to. But yeah, you know, we figured we've been going, we're almost in the double digits of episodes, and we're so stoked. There are so many patrons and people checking out the show and sharing it. It's very, very cool. And we'd love to get some direction from you guys, stuff that you want us to touch on or questions that you have about us and our relationship to the party or about the show. Anything at all, we are open books. Emails hello@seriousdangerpod.com.
Whatever way you look at it, Novak Djokovic is a lying, sneaky... Yes.
He's an asshole.
Asshole.
He is an asshole.
Did they do the right thing by him? I don't know.
No, I don't.
They fucked it up.
All right, let's talk Novaks, baby.
Novaks.
Everyone's been talking about Novak Djokovic this week. The Serbian world tennis number one, renowned vaccine skeptic and former COVID-19 patient, received a visa in November of last year to come to Australia for this year's Australian Open. That's a little bit weird. He's not double vaccinated, but he managed to get a medical exemption approved by Tennis Australia's chief medical officer and a Victorian government independent expert panel. We don't know what that exemption was.
Love that.
Some would say that because he had COVID-19, that was his exemption. But no. Then the government is saying that if you're unvaccinated, having had COVID-19 in the past 6 months, does not get you out of quarantine if you were to come to Australia. But anyway, got an exemption, got the visa, arrived in Australia on January the 5th. Border Force apparently fucked him around a little bit, cancelled his visa. He was put into immigration detention in the Park Hotel in Carlton, Melbourne for four grueling nights. There was outrage. There were vigils outside his hotel. His dad, he compared his treatment to the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. It was everywhere. I'm sure people across these details. Then a court overturned that cancellation of the visa, said he was fine. He was granted visa. We heard some more details about some inaccuracies he made on his travel documents. And we also learned that apparently when Novak Djokovic has COVID, he doesn't give a fuck and will happily lick children, go to all the events.
The twists and turns.
One day when he tested positive in December last year, he knew he was positive, and he still went to his tennis center in Belgrade to uphold a long-standing commitment for a L'Equipe interview because he felt obliged and didn't want to let the journalist down. You can't let journalists down, Emerald.
Oh, I hate it when I let a journalist down. They've never let me down.
No, they're always helping you. So I think like public opinion's turned against him a little bit on that front. And now at the time of recording, we still don't know what Immigration Minister Alex O'Hawke is going to do. The power is vested in him. He could cancel Djokovic's visa again on sort of a character grounds or the idea that he's some kind of public health risk. And even if that visa cancellation does happen, which probably you'll know about by the time this podcast comes out, there'll still be an appeal process. So it will still continue and carry on. It's been a wild saga that the media has been eating up like crazy, and obviously lots of people are very much invested. He's a very popular tennis player and brings up a whole lot of questions about borders and COVID-19 and such. Mm. What has been your Novak take this week, Emerald?
I'm still on holiday, so I'm still not paying a whole lot of attention. But I feel like my take, people love a COVID villain. People absolutely, yes. Like since the beginning of the pandemic or perhaps since, you know, more strict regulations came into place, and yeah, people love finding someone who has broken them and just like they fucking hate that person, and that's what the news is about for, you know, weeks. I think with Djokovic it's justified because he's rich, and I hate him because he's rich probably more than I hate him for everything else. But even with the kind of vitriol that he has experienced, I still think that it's like the real world consequences for him will be less than we would have seen for example, the like two young women of color that crossed into Queensland. Folks might remember it's years ago now,
right.
But yeah, had their faces plastered on the front of what was it, the Courier or the Daily Telegraph, and basically doxed and face charges and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Look, I think it's one of those things where you can hate a variety of different people. Everybody sucks. Novak Djokovic is definitely wrong. He's on the record as having some pretty wacky anti-science positions. In his autobiography, Serve to Win, about watching a test in which a researcher directed loving energy towards one glass of water and swore aggressively at the other. After a few days, he wrote, the belittled glass was tinted slightly green. The other glass was still bright and crystal clear.
Oh, my God. I've heard of this water theory. Yeah, yeah.
apparently that's his water theory. If you yell and swear at a glass of water, it will change color. In April 2020, he said pretty much explicitly he was opposed to vaccination and he was curious about well-being and how we can empower our metabolism to be in the best shape to defend against imposters like COVID-19.
Go on.
So, look, I mean, I know there are a variety of opinions, but for me, the COVID vaccine is safe and very effective, and Novak Djokovic has an extraordinary, huge, influential platform, and would like to see someone like him shut the fuck up, stop being a baby, take the vaccine like the rest of us and to get on with your life. As Josh Butler tweeted, if I was Novak Djokovic, I would simply have taken two doses of the safe and effective COVID-19 vaccinations, then quietly collected my millions of dollars for playing tennis.
Exactly. That's what I mean. Like,
it's probably the best option. But it's like, okay, man, if you don't want the vaccine, then you don't get the exemption, okay? Because clearly that's been some dodgy ground. So Djokovic sucks. He should have got the vaccine. Tennis Australia sucks by trying to get him this exemption. And everyone who tries to get an exemption for the rich and powerful, which has happened throughout the entire pandemic, you know, there was some representation that, hey, rules are rules, all right? And everybody's been treated the same and Djokovic is not going to get an exemption. It's like, fuck you.
Them's the rules.
From the get-go, rich Hollywood actors arriving in Australia able to pay for their own quarantine and quarantine at home because they could pay for the security. The boss of Santos was crossing the WA border all the time and not having to quarantine because he was allowed to go out to mining sites and just check in and not shake too many hands or whatever, and he'd be totally fine. And if people remember, in August 2020, there was a Sydney businessman who got a travel exemption to go to Europe to pick up his luxury yacht, right? This was crucial travel that he had to undertake during a pandemic. And the government said, yeah, that's totally fine.
Even
that's
the
no
way
worry.
The rules were structured, the fact that you could cross a border to buy property, like this is what, you know, what's considered essential. Like, yeah.
So it's fine. But, of course, the real villain that we should focus on is the fact that Australia is insane when it comes to borders and the border regime that we impose on all sorts of migrants, people who are coming for a holiday, to work or what have you, as best up on a whole bunch of different fronts or in this case for a certain visa exemption for a specific purpose. But, of course, most notably is people who come to this country seeking a better life, seeking safety, fleeing from people that we've like waged war on as a country, apparently. And we will pop you into a detention facility forever, which is one of the political elements that came out of the Djokovic story as well, right? He was in the Park Hotel in Carlton. In that very same hotel are a bunch of people who have been there for a very, very long time or been in Australian immigration detention for a very, very long time because they had the temerity to arrive in this country by boat, and that's the worst possible thing that you can do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Here's one of those people, right? This is an extract from an ABC piece. Jamal, not his real name, fled the Taliban for safety in Australia, but he said it was Australia's ongoing and indefinite detention that had left him permanently scarred. The refugee, known as Jamal, described the anguish that led him to a drastic act, setting himself on fire while in detention on the Pacific island of Nauru. I got third-degree burn injuries, it's deep scars, and it will stay for my lifetime, he told the ABC. In mid-2013, the Rudd government declared that no asylum seeker who arrived in Australia by boat would ever be resettled in Australia, even if they were found to be a refugee. That policy has been continued by the current government, which refugee rights groups said was leaving people like Jamal in limbo for 8.5 years. Mm. He's being held in the Park Hotel in Melbourne's Inner North, where tennis star Novak Djokovic was recently kept in immigration detention before a judge quashed the cancellation of his visa. At the hotel, Jamal and several others contracted COVID-19 in October last year. His lawyer, Alison Batterson, worked to extract 110 people from Afghanistan when Kabul fell to the Taliban last year. She said that was a simpler process than trying to free her client. It is mind-blowing when you make that comparison, that it was easier to escape the Taliban than it is to be released from an Australian immigration detention centre.
Yeah.
So you've got people in these kind of hotels and in immigration detention centres as well who have been there for, 9 years. They've been there since they were children. They've committed absolutely no crime.
Yeah.
And they've been recognised as refugees. They've had their claims accepted. These are people who are fleeing persecution. We owe them protection under international law, but we've said that you cannot possibly be resettled in this country, and so you're just in this insane fucking limbo for a very long time. Conditions at the Park Hotel are extreme. The men are free to leave their rooms, but not the hotel. There is little fresh air. There are reports in December that meals have been contaminated with maggots. It's fucking brutal and horrific.
Yeah.
And there has been this attention, this media interest in the plight of these people seeking asylum while the attention has been on Novak at the same time. do you think that's a good thing, a political opportunity? Is it cutting through? What do you think?
Yeah, like, and I think that because I saw quite a few folks on the left kind of focusing their attention on people who were maybe just now interested in you know, immigrants' rights or the rights of asylum seekers and the conditions of facilities like this. Mm. And I think certainly like only being interested in those conditions when they apply to a wealthy tennis player is cooked. But yes. There were people who were saying, I'd never thought about the conditions of these refugees until Djokovic was in there.
Yeah.
And then people saying, well, you know, having a go at them and the fact that they'd been ignorant. And that is something that really pisses me off when it's like, yeah, that you're trying to get someone to understand something and to care about something, but then as soon as they do, they haven't understood it in the right way or yeah. they haven't understood it quickly enough and like they're an idiot and they should have understood it sooner. It's like, no, any kind of, you know, avenue into radicalization or politicization I think is a positive thing. Mm. And it also, yeah, I do think that shining a light on these atrocities is important, and if it weren't, the government wouldn't go to such great lengths to keep this behind closed doors. I remember, I guess it was last year or maybe even the year before, but when there were sustained blockades and camps outside of these hotels where refugees were being held, medevac refugees, and in Brisbane, they would do things like, for example, close off the balconies so that the refugees, the men, could no longer come out and speak to people or wave to people or hold signs, because that was creating this vision that actually was, you know, useful for media and kind of capturing the public attention. They wouldn't allow, you know, they wouldn't allow us to do things like give them food, but particularly, yeah, they were shutting them away from the public because that was something to actually see someone's face who has been shut inside one of these facilities for 8 years or so for absolutely no crime, to see their wife and children standing outside of the gate, you know, speaking up to them through a microphone or through a phone, just begging to be able to hug their husband or their father. Like, that is what the government does not want you to see, that is a result of their cruel asylum seeker regime.
Mm. It's actually been remarkable. There was a campaign a couple of years ago to try and take away people, detainees' phones, right? Like the government's trying to pull some bullshit national security nonsense, or that some of these people are pedophiles, like just fucking gross racist shit, to take away phones, which are a lifeline from people in detention to the outside world, you know, something that really makes a huge difference for their mental health and just, you know, their ability to hang on to their humanity while they're trapped in these detention centers. And they lost that appeal and they got to hang on to their phones. And then ever since too, it's pretty remarkable. You're seeing people who are detained doing Zoom interviews. You know, Mehdi Ali, who came to Australia when he was 15, has been detained ever since then, just turned 24, so he's been there for 9 fucking years. He's on international media, right, giving interviews about his experience. We can see people's faces, we can hear their names, and one would hope that stuff does cut through, because unfortunately the way public opinion works isn't perhaps the way we would like it to.
Yeah.
And you need cute faces, you need individual stories, you need sympathetic cases to certainly get the kind of media coverage that you want and to try and cut through and make a bit of an impact. Now, there are some people in the refugee rights movement who really despise that and want to push back against that and say that, you know, human rights is for everyone, and even if you're a young man who might intimidate some people in middle white Australia with your appearance and your age, you might be perceived as a threat. You know, obviously you don't deserve to be detained indefinitely either. You have human rights as well. But, you know, again, one would say that you probably have to take the win if people's attention are turning to this stuff and calling it out, even if it's via Novak Djokovic. That's probably a good thing, and hopefully we can use
it. It's not the be all and end all. Like, it's not the answer to the problem, but I think we can learn from it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm not going to be turning away people from the movement.
Sure.
Because they've come through this.
And, you know, a bunch of Greens folks were doing that. Steph Hodgins-May, the candidate for McNamara, did a event on Twitter Spaces with Peruz Buchani.
Mm.
I did not join. I refused to understand what Twitter Spaces is or what the fuck they were
click the little logo that they keep telling me to click.
But, you know, again, in very crude political terms, an opportunity for the Greens to make a lot of noise about this, remind people that this is the kind of thing that we're fighting for. Another key difference between us and the other so-called progressive party, Labor, because Labor introduced mandatory detention under the Keating government, and has maintained support for offshore detention, say they're opposed to indefinite detention. They say, oh, detention's, you know, we need it, but it shouldn't go on for years and years and years. But, of course, we'll refuse to back any kind of limit on detention, whereas the Greens have announced a policy of a 7-day limit on detention, increasing our humanitarian impact intake.
And that's onshore.
Onshore, yeah. Yes. Yes, exactly. Shutting down, closing the camps, absolutely 100%.
Yeah.
Yes, guaranteeing human rights of people, working on a regional solution with our neighbours so that you can actually stop people getting on boats and taking those dangerous journeys while also guaranteeing them dignity and safety and protecting their human rights. And, of course, having a Royal Commission into Australia's detention regime. We all love Royal Commissions, right?
The mandatory final dot point of every webpage of the Australian Greens.
So, look, I'm sure we're not telling you stuff you don't already know. The Greens are way better on refugee rights and, you know, the cynical part of me says that Novak Djokovic's story will end and folks will move on with their lives. And if this becomes an election issue, it will be in a very bad way. And the Morrison government will try to pull some, you know, strong borders bullshit that we need to fight against. And Labor will not take on that fight because they're not interested in it.
Yeah, I think, but I did just want to read, you know, there was a little bit in a piece by John O'Shree, the Greens councillor in Brisbane, about COVID and COVID regulations in general. But there's one piece where he talks about how this has made us think about borders that I think is relevant to this. And I'll just read it out. So he says, I think one of the tipping points for me was when a whole bunch of comparatively privileged people started complaining that their travel and ability to cross borders would be limited on the basis of their status and a piece of paper. This is talking about vaccines. I mean, that is literally what passports and national border controls have always been designed to do. If you think it's unjustified discrimination to prevent people from entering a country or crossing a border on grounds that you consider arbitrary, are you also opposed to restricting people's movement based on their nationality and age, which Australia does routinely? Mm. It seems to me that philosophically speaking, it's difficult for anti-mandate protesters to sustain the argument that border controls based on vaccination status are wrong, but border controls based on other characteristics like where someone was born or how much money they have are right. I guess this means a lot more people are joining the struggle against racist nationalism and border imperialism. If that's you, welcome aboard.
Welcome aboard.
Toot, toot.
Good evening. We begin with breaking news. The immigration minister has just cancelled the visa of world number one Novak Djokovic.
What do you think of the Hillsong stuff? Because as we're recording, this is the morning where everyone is freaking out about the fact that Hillsong had this massive, I mean, it really is, it's like a festival and everyone's singing and dancing and doing all the things that other people can't do because they can have a religious exemption.
Oh, there is actually an exemption for them. Is that right?
Oh, I thought so.
Holy fuck. Well, I think it's fine because they're protected by the love of Jesus, so they'll be fine and nothing can break that, not even Corona, the novel coronavirus. My understanding was that, yes, they did change the exemption to just include music festivals or something like that. Like they changed the language. They didn't say, hey, Hillsong's fine, but they put the restriction in such a way that the Hillsong themselves could interpret it to say that that they're exempt. Is that accurate?
Well, okay, hang on. I just looked it up and apparently police have ruled out any fine for the COVID breach. So that's cool. We love that's so the good. Police. Which everyone is going to fucking lose their mind about. Because it is, again, like it's like the Djokovic thing. It's the same. It's like this double standard that infuriates people, but also people just, even before the double standard is applied, people love finding someone to hate. And who is a better target, particularly in the context of our Prime Minister being, you know, Pentecostalist, Pentecostalist.
Pentecostal, yes,
Pentecostalist.
Yeah.
yeah, like who better to hate than singing and dancing Christians?
It is fun. Like it is pretty fun.
But it's kind of cringe because it brings out, I kind of also hate the like hyper anti-theist leftists online, the boomers who are like, well, actually, I read the Bible and
here are my notes. Yes, well, you're talking to someone who was quite a passionate new atheist for quite a while, and I do hope I've chilled out a little bit and I'm a little less of a dick, but I was on the Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris train for quite a while there, I'm sorry to say. But look, it is frustrating. People hate Hillsong for a range of reasons, you know, the music, but also the fact they don't pay taxes. They're part of the prosperity gospel shit. And, you know, the child abuse and the covering up therein and the close relationship to the Prime Minister. Now, I agree. We are a nation of cops and we should resist that at every possible opportunity that we have. But, yes, the double standard stuff does drive people furious. And if you look at what's happening in the UK at the moment, like, it's bonkers, okay? The Tory party in power, it's all coming out now. Someone is ingeniously leaking against Boris Johnson. and bringing out all this evidence of various events and parties that Tories had at number 10 Downing Street while the rest of the country was in lockdown. And that's particularly galling because these are the people who are fucking making the rules, right? They're making up the rules, imposing them on everybody's life for public health reasons and for good reason. And, you know, it's just been a PR disaster for the Tories because you've just got people saying, my mother died alone while you were having your little fucking party, right? Like it's pretty brutal and it cuts through. And I mean, my personal opinion is that the singing and dancing thing is pretty fucking stupid to begin with. So it's like, okay, this is a stupid law that we all have to abide by, but we get an exception for young Christians who are like passionate about Jesus.
Incredibly annoying, incredibly annoying. But it's also like, is this just another one of those things where we have this fervent hope that maybe this will be the thing that raises class consciousness in people? Like, it's almost like the hope that we had at the beginning of the pandemic, that it would like radicalize everyone and we would like restructure the economy and society. And all it ends up being is like that meme that's just the perfect encapsulation of Australia, where it's like Australia and it's the one, you know, the guy looking at the hot girl behind him while his girlfriend is like, why are you looking at her? And he's just looking at the thing that says more cops, and then his girlfriend is like, any other solution? When it's like, yeah, the answer is always just going to be more cops. So instead of us being like, maybe this points to a fundamental disparity in society when it comes to like wealth and power and certain political or religious or economic structures are afforded these particular privileges that ordinary folks, ordinary working people, and particularly people of color don't get. Maybe we need to do something about that structure and that system. Instead, it's like, no, we've been policed. We've been oppressed. They need to be policed and oppressed harder.
Yes, that's a good point. It is a very, again, centrist, liberal, small L liberal appeal, isn't it? Yeah. Always like citing the rules.
Very and,
like,
reactionary.
Here's the manual. And I'd like to speak to the manager because you didn't sort that out. And of course, yes, if you have a materialist analysis, something closer to, you know, a Marxist class analysis, you say, well, you can have all the rules you want. They're not going to apply to everybody equally because money
because and because money.
Capitalism.
Yeah.
And that's the way that the deal works. And even if you pass laws and all these restrictions and guidance, right, that in theory apply to everybody universally, when someone fucks up, if they're rich and powerful enough, they will find a way to get around it. And they'll get the exception and the exemption and they'll be patted on the head or maybe publicly scolded but let off.
There is one rule I would like to apply to everyone though, which is that no one is allowed to make any more of those fucking cringe annoying tweets that are like a call back to creating fake religions like Pastafarianism, where they're like, well, maybe I'm going to start jerking off and call it a religion and then I'll be allowed to jerk off on people or whatever they fucking want. Like, please don't make that joke anymore. That's all I ask.
Yeah, that's probably fair. Oh man, I'll send you a speech I gave at the Atheist Foundation convention from 2012.
Oh, is that what we're listening to next week?
I want to punch myself in the face watching it.
All right, that's what we're doing next week, folks. Tune in next week on Serious Danger to hear Tom's absolutely cringe speech.
On the upside, you know, with all these people getting away with certain stuff, just remember that at the end of the day, the ultimate judgment is in the hands of the Lord, and we will all be judged equally, rich and poor,
you make a good point.
Alike, and we'll be judged for all our decisions and choices. So if you're happy with that, if you can look the Lord in the eye and be happy with all the choices that you've made, Emerald Moon, then good luck to you.
Well, we're both probably going to hell.
Hallelujah.
All right, yes, Saturday night at the Atheist Convention. If someone tells you they're religious and they love God and they love Jesus, I say that is awesome, that is great, I totally respect that. Hey, you want to buy some of these magic beans?
All right, this week's guest, we've got another stellar Greens candidate for you. Celeste Little is a proud Arrernte woman, trade unionist, writer, First Nations activist, and the candidate for Cooper, formerly known as Batman, in Melbourne's Inner North. It's one of the most progressive seats in the country. For a long time, was an ALP stronghold until the Greens came along and fucked it up and made it a marginal seat a few years back, currently held by Jed Carney, and a real chance for the Greens with a fantastic candidate like Celeste. Hello, Celeste. Thanks very much for being on Serious Danger.
Thanks for having me on, folks. It's good to see you.
You too. I just wanted to start in your pinned tweet. People should follow you on Twitter at Utopiana. You write, I said I would never consider a career in politics. I still am not someone who considers politician to be a career. I very much think change happens at the grassroots and on the streets.
Yes.
If that is the case, why are you selling out, Celeste? Why are you getting part of the system, man, and running to become a dirty, dirty MP?
Oh, look, you know, it's kind of, there isn't one main reason. There's a couple of reasons. So I think the first is during the pandemic, during COVID, I became incredibly aware, I guess, for the first time, which sounds incredibly naive for a middle-aged Black woman, this community, which is, as you said, not one of the most progressive seats in the country. It actually is the most progressive voting seat in the country. This is the kind of seat where the Liberal Party doesn't even bother turning up to some booths to hand out how to vote cards because there's no point. Mm. They don't get a look in. So the democratic choice for residents of Cooper needs to be on the left, so that people actually do feel that they have a democratic choice and that their voices are heard no matter what they choose. Mm. And the Labor Party itself needs to be pressured a bit from the left, I believe, because they've been playing to the centre and indeed to the right.
No, that's wrong. Actually, Celeste.
Well.
That's incorrect, right? Emerald, like Celeste doesn't know what she's talking about. She's actually being evil by running against a progressive Labor woman.
And, you know, making it easier for the Libs to win. Don't you realise this?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, well, if I didn't realise that, I realised that after 3 weeks of online hounding from various people who I would have thought should have known a little bit more about democracy and the right to democratic choice, and people that call themselves feminists or you know, or union activists or whatever other sort of type of activists, piling onto an Indigenous woman for having the hide to run against a progressive Labor woman.
Well, as a woman, as a feminist, how could you run against a progressive Labor woman, you know?
And also telling me to run elsewhere. I think that one of the reasons why I did choose to run with the Greens is that we run in the communities that we actually live in, you know, with the people that we represent. I'm not some sort of stellar candidate who has been helicoptered into a seat to cause a ruckus.
Well, to be clear, you are a stellar candidate.
But. You're a stellar candidate, yes.
No, I don't know about that. But my pre-selection was by me putting my hand up. You know, I got asked if I'd be interested. So I thought about it for a few months and then decided, okay, look, I'll give this a shot.
Well, just to be clear, when you were announced in May 2021, Victorian Labor MP Martin Bakula tweeted, "Yep, the Greens are going to fight back against the Liberals and advocate for working people by throwing everything they have at trying to knock Jed Carney, someone who's actually spent her entire working life doing those things, out of Parliament. Right on, you champions." And for folks who don't know, Jed Carney was a former secretary or president of the ACTU, the Australian Council
president
of Trade Unions.
President of the ACTU. Yeah.
President, there you go. Okay. And then this sort of came up again this past week. There was a big profile in the Australian newspaper about Max Chandler Mather, the Greens candidate in Griffith, about this massive door-knocking campaign, this people-powered grassroots campaign that the Greens have mounted to win Griffith's already overtaken Adam Band's campaign to try and take Melbourne back in 2010, like a really massive people-powered campaign that are getting people on out of the streets talking about Greens policies. And Tanya Plibersek tweeted out that article with her thoughts saying, "Every moment spent campaigning against progressive Labor women MPs," he's campaigning against Terry Butler, the shadow environmental minister, "makes it easier for Scott Morrison to remain prime minister." And this is something we see again and again. The Greens should never run against any Labor MP, apparently, because we're just helping out the Liberals, and particularly not progressive Labor women, for goodness sakes, because they're progressive and they're women and you're allowed to disturb their hold on power. And I know this only really concerns probably politicos, people who are paying close attention to the ins and outs of Auspol and on Twitter, but it really does seem to give the impression that Labor thinks they deserve these seats, that I assume they want to run completely unopposed and cannot possibly be challenged from the left because they're the Labor Party and they're progressive Labor women, even if they're bound by Labor policy, which a lot of the time is fucking dog shit.
Not progressive at all.
At all. But firstly, to Emerald, I'd love to hear from you. Like, how do you, I assume you've come up against this all the time as a former candidate yourself and working on campaigns for Greens running against Labor MPs. How do you respond to this? Should we actually care about it, or should we just dismiss it as the bad faith argument that it is?
Oh, it's absolutely bad faith, but it is, like, it's interesting because there's the totally bad faith argument from Labor that says that is, yeah, basically it's predicated on the assumption that they have some sort of innate right to the seat a lot of the time. Like we saw it in Queensland when, you know, Amy McMahon for the Greens won the seat from Jackie Trad, their kind of so-called like progressive left hero. But they are so angry at her, like as though she stole the seat when, you know, she was voted in the same as anyone else. It's so easy to tear down that argument. I think there are people within the Greens who fall for that to some extent, or who have this argument that sits under that where they think that we feed too much money and too much resources into Labor seats and we should be focusing all of our, like all of our funding and resources and everything on Liberal seats because it's more important that we kick out Libs. But I feel like that kind of, it misses the point that it's like we should focus where we can win, right?
Mm. Yeah, I have so many thoughts about this. So Martin Pakula really showed his ass when he tweeted that. It was hilarious. It was incredibly wrong. It was ridiculous. Like when the Greens released the idea for the crossbench, and that was back in March 2020 when that was hitting the news, Cooper wasn't a target seat. So the idea, like the idea that heaps of resources are being thrown at this seat in order to unseat a progressive Labor woman is just not correct. I am the resource. Me and the incredible campaign team and the volunteers that we have. So it is completely grassroots. Do Labor think that they own this seat? Absolutely they do. Apart from a short time in the late 60s and then at the very beginning of the seat, Labor have held it, and they've held it for incredible margins. Like, you know, I think it was 26% at one point. It's been for years one of the safest Labor seats in the country. So they do believe they own it.
Yeah.
That whole idea of democracy and democratic choice, it just doesn't seem to play out in those sorts of arguments. Like, we're running for House of Representatives seats here.
Mm.
So therefore, those seats are divvied up via suburbs and postcodes and whatever sort of arbitrary boundaries that the Electoral Commission sets. And the representative part is, to me, says representative of that community, you know. It's not the idea that we should be running elsewhere, you know, apart from the communities that we live in as Greens people, just makes absolutely no sense to me. It's sort of, you know, these are our communities. So our communities deserve the right to have a choice where they live, who represents them. But also too, you know, it is such a furphy. Like the Greens run in nearly every seat cross country.
Mm-hmm.
So we are running against Liberals.
Exactly.
Mm. We are running against Labor people. We are running against independents that are popular. We're running everywhere.
To give people that choice.
Right.
Because that's why even when it's hard to find a candidate, we will search for someone because we want people to have a choice to vote for our platform, which, to be clear, is not the platform of Labor. Like, it's very different.
Yeah.
Yes.
If it were the same platform, we wouldn't bother.
Yeah.
Exactly. And this is surely at the heart of the Labor argument, right? There is no real choice. Hey, we're all progressive. We're all supposed to be on the same team. Therefore, you shouldn't run against us because that just splits resources. Like, well, no.
Yeah.
Well, one party is... has just caved on tax cuts for the rich and the Buffett rule. That's Labor, by the way. Labor's come out as pro-coal, now explicitly pro-coal, and refuses to wind down the fossil fuel industry while there's still demand out there. Anthony Albanese is out there in Queensland sort of saying we are on board coal as long as there's demand for it. Tax cuts for the rich, political donations from fossil fuel industry and corporate political donations. And on the question of people seeking asylum and refugee rights, there is a substantial difference. I know Jed Carney is very outspoken and has been in the past about refugee rights, but at the end of the day, she will vote with her party, which thinks that the indefinite mandatory detention of people seeking asylum, a contravention of their human rights and international law, is the way to go. And they've refused to take on that fight and push back against the Fortress Australia regime.
Mm-hmm.
So there is clearly a whole lot of room to the left of the Labor Party that the Greens occupy. And I'm sorry, if you're not into campaigning for the seat that you have and taking place in the battle of ideas and trying to change people's minds and prove to voters that you deserve their vote, get the fuck out of politics, you know?
Absolutely.
Mm.
Maybe we can kind of shift direction a little bit here. Before we finish up, wanted to talk about this kind of this phenomenon probably been happening maybe by stealth over the last, you know, year or 6 months even, and coming to the fore, I think, with the fires at Old Parliament House recently. The infiltration of First Nations groups and communities by conspiracy theory groups. So predominantly like sovereign citizens and folks who have links to QAnon. And a lot of the time, yeah, linked with anti-vax and all this kind of broad tent conspiracy theories. I'm keen to get your take on this because my view is that it looks like, you know, these groups are quite cynically infiltrating communities to use Black folks as almost a shield against criticism, particularly from the left. And I think it is sometimes an effective wedge on the left. And we saw that with the confusion around the fire at Old Parliament House. Like, what do you think?
I think it's incredibly complicated. So what we're seeing play out is, you know, the Indigenous sovereignty movement, which is based on, you know, ancestral ties, based on land rights, based on the fact that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people never ceded their sovereignty to the Crown. So, you know, we are a pre-treaty country. And that wrong won't be rectified until we've addressed that. That combined with arguments of individual sovereignty and the rights of sovereign people as a sovereign, you know, sort of body to reject infringements upon civil liberties, and the whole sort of anti-vax movement and how they've been able to grab onto the individual sovereignty thing, try and combine it with the Indigenous sovereignty movement, and cause a bit of a mishmash of ideas there. You know, you can see how that arises when, and I've written articles about this, when a lot of the pandemic response, rather than being about boosting public health and social safety nets and public housing and so on and so forth, has been about policing communities and having huge fines for people. And when the stats are showing that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are being targeted, you can kind of see why there's a section of the community that will fight back against that. There's also a history, and I think Naoka Gori wrote a magnificent article about this, which talked about the history of lock hospitals and Aboriginal people being medically tested upon. Mm-hmm. It talked about the biological warfare, such as, you know, smallpox running rampant through communities as a way of committing genocide, and there being a distrust in an Indigenous distrust in governments. And when they do mandate things like vaccines, there is a distrust that comes back. However, all that aside, I'm really unpacking this.
No, it's important. You
know, all that aside, the reason why the tent embassy still exists is because land rights doesn't exist yet. You know, we still haven't had our sovereignty as First Nations people properly recognised by so-called Australia. That fight is ongoing. As Gary Foley says, native title is not land rights, you know. And what we're seeing at Parliament House with this sort of group coming in and infiltrating what is a long-standing, you know, ongoing monument to the land rights and sovereignty movement, the people, the tent embassy people themselves and the traditional owners of Canberra, so-called Canberra, have both put out statements denouncing the actions of these other groups that are coming in, particularly when we're looking, this year is the 50th anniversary of the tent embassy, particularly when, you know, one of their actions was to burn the front doors of Old Parliament House. Mm-hmm. And due to an occupation that happened in Old Parliament House in the early 90s, which involved a lot of Aboriginal activists, including Uncle Charlie Perkins, the Old Parliament House has actually become a place that contains a lot of the archives of the history of the Tent Embassy and is therefore, you know, quite important. You've got the Museum of Democracy and then this juxtaposition with the Tent Embassy. So, I find it's really troubling, and I'm deeply concerned considering that we don't have land rights yet. You know, there is no treaties. that an anniversary such as the 50th anniversary of the Tent Embassy could potentially be hijacked by a bunch of people who are playing quite a different argument.
Yes, quite a different argument. I'll put this in the show notes too. There's a great piece from Jack Lettermore that really gives you a lowdown of exactly how these groups relate to the Tent Embassy and other First Nations movements for justice. I did not realise this. Just really quickly, this is a quote from that piece. A series of virtual meetings between prominent Indigenous group members and non-Indigenous alt-right activists suggest a plot to effectively copy the US Capitol Hill insurrection. Yeah. For the Australian version, the target is Old Parliament House. They believe the quasi-mystical locus of power in Australia is vested in the seat of the Old Parliament House because that is the address listed on the ABN registrations of the Commonwealth's Economy and Trade Departments. The new Parliament House, the seat of federal government since 1988, is pretend, they say, and the government's jurisdiction fiction. Okay, so there's this kind of like mystical location all based around Old Parliament House, which has no influence or power whatsoever anymore. And that's sort of like why it's the focus of their burning shit down.
I mean, this is just like, that's how sovereign citizen stuff. It's just like hyper Bush lawyering, you know, like reading the Constitution being like, I think this. But yeah, it's like all conspiracy theories. It plays on very real fears and very real, you know, historical anxieties that have a basis in class and race and everything like that. But I think that ultimately I'm worried about the effective wedge that it can have on the Greens. I think that the Greens have lost a few like First Nations members and people from the movement to this sovereign citizen, kind of this conspiracy theory incursion, which to be clear does not come from, First Nations people. Like it's some people, you know, First Nations people involved now, but that's not its origin. Yeah. So I think it's, I guess, as you say, Celeste, it's remembering exactly, you know, what do we support? What was this initially formed to fight for? To fight for sovereignty, to fight for land rights. And that's, I guess, where Greens people and particularly, you know, non-Indigenous Greens folks like ourselves, Tom and I, allies who want to kind of be there for First Nations folks, just remember exactly what we're fighting for and stand by them in that.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if that dude, like that Chimiriquai lookalike dude's going to rock up to this version of it. Because that was something else.
Well, that I can get on board. He's got some great shoots. look, we're out of time. I'm sorry, Celeste. We could keep talking to you for a very long time. But people can obviously help you out and support the campaign for Cooper. We want to turn Cooper green. We can totally do it. And we've got a fantastic candidate in you. So people should definitely check out your website and volunteer and help out where they can to help turn Cooper green. Is there anything in particular coming up that you want to plug or mention that people can get involved with if they want to help you out?
Look, the main thing I think that we need right now is more volunteers. We did have things planned, but COVID, So we're currently re-looking at some of the events and activities that we were going to be running as fundraisers, as community building sort of exercises. But I think that if people want to keep abreast of what's coming up, the best way to do that is probably to jump on my Greens website, which is littlelidddla.greens.org.au and just, chuck the details in the volunteer thing, the volunteer section. Someone will contact you and you can volunteer for everything from hosting a placard to being involved in door knocks and leafleting, to events. There's a lot of opportunities there. We're just hoping to get some really exciting stuff off the ground, because the one thing that I did forget to say about this seat is that it's an incredibly wonderful multicultural and creative seat. So there's so many things that we want to celebrate in this campaign. We'd love more people on the ground ready to roll when we're actually able to, and when we don't have this dark cloud of virus hanging over our heads.
That'd be nice.
Fantastic. Thanks, Celeste Little. Lovely to hang out
with you so much.
All the best, comrade. Solidarity.
No worries. Thank you.
See you when you make it to Parliament.
Hi, I'm Christopher Pyne, and welcome to Pyne Time. My guest today is Jackie Trad. So with Gladys and the ICAC in New South Wales,
I felt very sad. For Gladys. It just seemed like incredible timing.
Hey, that's pretty much our show this week, everybody. Thank you for listening, as always. We have a call to action, something that you can do considering the events of this week and what we discussed on the show. Huge shout out to the Refugee Action Collective. There are chapters across the country, but in Victoria, it's rac-vic.org. They have been just, you know, endlessly supportive of people in detention, have been making the calls for justice, organising rallies for years and years and years. They are having an action on Monday, 17th of January. That is tomorrow, if you listen to this on the day it comes out, 11 a.m. at Birrung Ma in Melbourne. That is a rally for refugees. They're saying, hey, Jovac's released, now free the refugees, okay? He'll be fine. He's a millionaire tennis player. Think about those people who are trapped inside. So it's based around the Australian Open. Go to their website and you'll find out more details about that. Also, Rise Refugees, fantastic. That is all led by ex-detainees and refugees and people seeking asylum. They do fantastic work. And I know it's a very small thing, but if you want to, you know, hear more from people directly, you know, the people who are living this shit, Mehdi Ali is on Twitter at MehdiAli98, because that's the year he was born, for fuck's sake. But he's, you know, doing a lot of media out there, and I think is a really articulate advocate for people who are detained and who has been putting up with the bullshit that our government imposes on them for a very, very long time. So check him out at MehdiAli98.
All that stuff is in the show notes. And another reminder as well, like we mentioned at the start of the show, we're going to do an AMA, Ask Us Anything, next week. We'll dedicate a bit of time to kind of talking about what you guys want us to talk about. Any questions that you have, please send them to us. Shoot us a DM. We're on Twitter and Instagram at SeriousDangerAU, or you can email us at hello@seriousdangerpod.com.
Do it, y'all.
Do it.
Serious Danger is produced by Mikey Mike Griffin, a wonderful producer, and made possible with the help of the Green Institute. You can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening. Or, yeah, reach out on social media at SeriousDangerAU. Check us out on Patreon too if you've got some spare cash to help us cover the costs of making this thing. All the details at SeriousDangerPod.com. Thank you, dear Emerald.
Goodbye. We love you.
We love yous. Bye.
Bye.
Serious Danger, Australia.
Delicious content.